We reflect today on Israeli Independence Day, or in Hebrew, Yom Ha'atzma'ut, and also on the moment in the Six-Day War known as Yom Yerushalayim, when the old city of Jerusalem was captured by the IDF. These are, for those who observe them, the most recent additions to the Jewish cycle of religious celebrations. They are, in one sense, similar to the other holidays in our calendar, but in another way, they are profoundly different. In order to truly understand why we celebrate these brightest moments in recent Jewish history, we must begin with the conclusion of the darkest moment in recent Jewish history. April 11th, 1945, the day Buchenwald was liberated by Patton's army, the month in which the Holocaust came to a close. As the American forces approached the camp, many inmates, having longed for liberation, ran to the gates, and as they did so, the Nazis, in a final attempt at murdering the inmates, opened fire from the guard tower. One young boy with the Yiddish nickname of Lulik, the youngest survivor of Buchenwald, was suddenly in the line of fire. And then, out of nowhere, someone jumped upon him and held him down until the shooting had stopped. Lulik did not see who had shielded him, who had saved him. He then got up, ran away from the person who had held him down, and cowered behind a pile of corpses as the Americans entered. With them was a chaplain in Patton's Third Army, Rabbi Herschel Schachter. As the New York Times reports, and I draw both on the Times and on this young boy's future memoir, there in filthy barracks, men lay on raw wooden planks stacked from floor to ceiling. They stared down at the rabbi in his unfamiliar military uniform with unmistakable fright. And then this very strange-looking person opened his mouth and spoke a language they knew. Shalom Aleichem Yidden, Rabbi Schachter cried in Yiddish. Ihr seid frei. You are free. He ran from barracks to barracks, joined by those Jews who could walk, until a stream of people swelled behind him. As he passed a mound of corpses, Rabbi Schachter spied a flicker of movement. Drawing closer, he saw a small boy hiding in terror behind the mound of bodies. Rabbi Schachter picked the boy up. Wie alt bist du, mein Kind? He asked in Yiddish. What difference does it make? Replied the seven-year-old. I'm older than you anyway. Why do you think you're older? Rabbi Schachter asked, smiling despite himself. Because you cry and laugh like a child, Lulik replied. And I haven't laughed in a long time, and I don't even cry anymore. So which one of us is older? Rabbi Schachter took the boy by the hand and made the rounds of the barracks, announcing the liberation. Shalom Aleichem Yidden. You are free. 5 decades later, this young boy, whose actual name was Yisrael Meir Lau, the youngest survivor of Buchenwald, became the chief rabbi of the State of Israel. It is one of many examples of how out of the ashes of the European Holocaust, a people have built a country that is a beacon of democracy and the wonder of our age. And it is an embodiment of a vision described in Yechezkel in the prophet Ezekiel millennia ago. The prophet describes how he was shown by God a valley filled with parched skeletons, which suddenly take on physical flesh, and then the spirit of life. Ezekiel is informed of the meaning of what he saw. Son of man, says God, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they, Israel, says, Yovsha atzmotenu v'ovda tikvatenu. Our bones are dried, and our hope is lost. We are cut off. And then God replies, thus saith the Lord God, behold, O my people, I will open your graves and cause you to come out of your graves and bring you into the land of Israel, and you shall know that I am the Lord. It is this passage in Ezekiel that served as a source for Hatikva, which became Israel's anthem. In response to Israel's plaintive biblical cry, Ovda tikvatenu, our hope is lost, Jews began to sing, Od lo avda tikvatenu, our hope has not been lost. Indeed, it has not. The fact that the youngest survivor of Buchenwald can become the chief rabbi of a flourishing, mighty, prosperous Jewish state reminds us that we are witness today to not merely an extraordinary moment in Jewish history, but to a fulfillment of biblical prophecy. The birth of the third Jewish commonwealth is not merely a remarkable historical occurrence, it is something that is salvific and miraculous. To mark the commemoration of an historical occurrence as a holiday in the Jewish covenantal calendar is to declare that we will forever remember this day because on it we experienced God's hand in history, and that the Jewish people, the chosen people, are the primary vehicle whereby that hand in history is made manifest. Like Tu B'Shvat or Hanukkah, holidays which evolved over time, I believe that these modern days of celebration will evolve from the infancy in which they now are to more formalized forms of celebration within religious Zionist communities. Yet there is one liturgical commonality experienced by many who celebrate. And that is the recitation on these days of the series of psalms known as Hallel, which gives gratitude to the divine for his miraculous salvation. Toward the conclusion of these psalms, the following verse is sung. Me'et Hashem haitazot, hiniflat pe'einenu. This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. We announce thereby that we have been witness with our own eyes and in our own age to divine intervention and to a fact that was eloquently expressed by Milton Himmelfarb, who wrote, quote, "Each Jew knows how thoroughly ordinary he is, yet taken together we seem caught up in things great and inexplicable. It is almost," he writes, "as if we were not acting, but being acted through. The number of Jews in the world," wrote Himmelfarb, "is smaller than a small statistical error in the Chinese census. Yet, we remain bigger than our numbers. Big things seem to happen around us and to us," end quote. To celebrate the new Israel-oriented holidays is to see Israel's story as nothing less than the greatest proof for God's existence and the chosenness of the Jewish people in our time. And we can now begin to appreciate why marking moments in the story of the modern Jewish state is similar to, but also different from, the holidays that we have previously discussed. To remember the Exodus, the journey through the desert, or the Hasmonean dedication of the temple, or the defeat of Haman, is also to recall the salvation of God and the entry by God into history. In this, our new holidays are similar, and yet they are also unique. For while the previous holidays occurred because of the actions of biblical heroes, prophets, or priests, on Yom HaAtzma'ut and Yom Yerushalayim, we invoke the miracles of the God of Israel that was achieved and produced by Jews who did not necessarily act in the name of the God of Israel or even believe in the God of Israel. And this becomes clear when we study the very moments right before the birth of Israel itself. On the 14th of May, 1948, David Ben-Gurion and his Zionist compatriots were poised to declare the first Jewish commonwealth in almost two millennia. Israel's founders, however, were delayed, bogged down in a matter of textual minutiae. Rabbi Fishman Maimon, rabbinic representative of the religious Zionist movement, proclaimed himself unwilling to sign any declaration of independence that made no reference to the God of Israel. Meanwhile, Aharon Zisling, the secular head of the socialist party Mapam, asserted that he could not affirm the existence of a God in whom he did not believe. So imagine, if you will, ladies and gentlemen, the strangeness of this moment. The British were departing. The Arab armies were descending. The fate of the Zionist project, the hopes and dreams of millions, hung in the balance, and the Jews were debating whether God exists. It was Ben-Gurion himself at this moment who proposed a compromise. Israel's declaration of independence would conclude by asserting that the signers placed their trust in the Tzur Yisrael, the Rock of Israel, a phrase from the Jewish liturgy. By referring to the Rock of Israel, but refraining from any explicit mention of divine redemption, Israel's declaration was one that both devout and atheistic Zionists could affirm. For believers in the Bible, the phrase could refer to the divine defender of the Jewish people. For the secular socialist signers of the document, the words would instead make reference to the flint-like resolution of the IDF. The compromise was accepted, and the modern Jewish state was born by eliding the issue of the existence of God. For those, however, who celebrate Israeli Independence Day as a religious holiday, removing God from a document did not actually do away with God's role in the divinely directed drama that is Jewish history. In fact, the contrary is true. Sidney Morgenbesser, the kibbutzing Columbia philosopher, once inquired at the end of his life the following from a colleague. He said, "Why is God making me suffer so much? Just because I don't believe in him?" Morgenbesser's droll dialectic captures for people of faith something profound. It is those agnostic of God's existence who often end up reifying that very same existence. In a much more profound sense, the events that preceded and followed Israel's declaration of statehood are so staggering that providence alone explains them. Harry Truman, whom no one had ever expected to become president of the United States, overrode his hero, General Marshall, in supporting and recognizing the birth of a Jewish state, and did so in part because of his relationship with a Jew named Eddie Jacobson, with whom Truman had run a haberdashery business decades before. Stalin, whose anti-Semitism rivaled Hitler's, ordered the Soviet bloc at the United Nations to support partition and then allowed Czechoslovakia to sell airplanes and arms to the nascent state. The Jews of the IDF, fighting against overwhelming odds, did indeed illustrate flint-like toughness in their heroic victory. But sense can only be made of these moments if something else, someone else, was at work as well. This was most eloquently expressed by two very different, extraordinary intellects of our time, who made separately the very same point. The first was Paul Johnson, a British Catholic historian, who reflected as follows, quote, "In the last half century, over 100 completely new independent states have come into existence. Israel is the only one whose creation can fairly be called a miracle. I observed the drama of 1948 to 49, he writes, from the security of an ancient Oxford college where I was an undergraduate. Academic opinion was then on balance, favorable to the new Zion, but opinion was also virtually unanimous that the state would be crushed. That was assuredly the view of most governments and military staffs. Another paradoxical aspect of the Zionist miracle," Johnson adds, "is that among the founding fathers of Israel was Joseph Stalin. Stalin," he writes, "had no love for Jews. Had he lived, he might well have carried out an extermination program rivaling Hitler's. Moreover, like Lenin before him, Stalin had always opposed Zionism. But," Johnson continues, "during the crucial years, 1947 to 48, Stalin was guided by temporary considerations of realpolitik and specifically by what he saw as the threat of British imperialism. Thus," Johnson concludes, "in terms of both Soviet and of American policy, Israel slipped into existence through a window that briefly opened and just as suddenly closed. Once again, timing, or if one likes, providence, was of the essence." End quote. This is Paul Johnson. And then there is Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, who in a famous speech describing the divine knock of the beloved of the Bible, a reference to God's hand in history, Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote as follows. "Both Russia and the Western countries jointly supported the idea of the establishment of the state. This was perhaps the only proposal where East and West were united. I am inclined to believe," Rabbi Soloveitchik continued, "that the United Nations organization was created," he means by God, "created specifically for this purpose, in order to carry out the mission which divine providence had set for it. It seems to me," reflected Rabbi Soloveitchik, "that one cannot point to any other concrete achievement on the part of the United Nations," end quote. Now, he said this in the 1960s, and the achievements of the UN in the 50 years since then, or the lack thereof, only makes his point more profound. The miraculous nature of Israel's birth is reflected, as Rabbi Soloveitchik once noted, in the colors of its flag. The blue and white stripes of the flag of Israel were taken from the tallit, the Jewish prayer shawl, which often bore these colors as a symbol of the colors of the prayer shawl's fringes, known as tzitzit. According to the Torah, tzitzit were meant to be composed of white strings combined with Petil Techelet, fringes dyed sky blue. Rabbi Soloveitchik, in an elucidation of this mitzvah, of this biblical commandment, once suggested that the strings that are white connote clarity, that which is self-evident. They bespeak the power of the human mind to perceive, to deduce, to investigate, and to innovate. But then there is Tehillet, the blue strings, according to the Talmud, an embodiment of the furthest reaches of heaven itself. Tehillet, the blue, Rabbi Soloveitchik said, symbolizes the perennial mysteries of life that resist rationalization. The very blueness of the sky, he added, is due only to the distance from which man observes it. In his words, while the color white refers to the clearly perceptible, the blue refers to a realm that is only barely grasped. End quote. It is, in other words, a reminder of what Hamlet said to Horatio, that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. And the blue and the white of tzitzit are worn by Jews as a reminder of the Jewish relationship with God, Rabbi Soloveitchik said, because these colors together bespeak both the Jewish faith in human capacity while simultaneously reminding us of the mystery of Jewish chosenness. How appropriate, then, that these colors ultimately adorned the symbol of the Jewish state. Zionism was predicated on the ability of the Jewish people to achieve even the impossible if it put its mind to it. As Herzl famously said, "Im tirtzu ein zo agada," if you will it, it is no dream. And it is indeed an immense human achievement. But it is also a sign of the divine in our lives. This means that a profound irony lies at the heart of celebrating Israeli Independence Day as a religious holiday, because to do so means that we mark, commemorate, and celebrate not only what modern Zionism achieved, but also we celebrate what many modern Zionists did not achieve. Zionism, in its secular incarnation, sought in statehood the normalization of the Jewish people, and thereby the end of anti-Semitism. In the end, it achieved everything but that. Israel is a flourishing modern democracy, but it is also a reminder of the mystery of Jewish chosenness. That is why it is loved by many, but that is also why it is hated by many. Israel truly is Lavan and Tchelet, white and blue, simultaneously a modern democratic marvel and also an enduring reminder of the mystery that is the endurance of the chosen people. And to many Jews today, to many Israelis today, this is scary. One secular Israeli that I taught in Israel once told me how she was traveling overseas. She met a Christian, I believe an evangelical Christian, who, as you know, are very taken with Israel and the miracle which they believe Israel embodies. This Christian told her that you are a member of the chosen people, and as I recall, the student was, to use the technical term, freaked out by what the Christian had said to her. But this does not mean that the Christian was wrong. He was not. It is scary to think that as Jews, we are vehicles of a larger plan. Scary even if, or perhaps especially if, we are instruments in that larger providential plan coming into being. There's a joke that I was told about a secular Israeli. This joke was actually told to me by a secular Israeli. Very famous joke about an Israeli who's looking for a parking spot in Jerusalem and he can't find one. And he finally, for the first time in his life, looks up to heaven and prays. And he says to God, "God, if you help me find a makom chanaya, a parking spot, ani yeshmor Shabbat, ani yeshmor kashrut, I'll keep Shabbat, I'll keep kosher, I'll do everything." And then right in front of him, a massive truck that was parked pulls out, leaving this big open space. And immediately the Israeli looks up and says to heaven, "Lo chashuv, kfar matzati." Never mind, I just found one, okay? So the fact that you were an instrument in the occurrence of a miracle is at times frightening and a motivation to actually deny that the miracle actually occurred. One is reminded of J.R.R. Tolkien's children's book, The Hobbit, where the heroism of the central character, Bilbo Baggins, leads to the fulfillment of a legendary prophecy. At the end of the book, Bilbo exclaims to Gandalf the wizard, quote, "Then the prophecies of the old songs have turned out to be true, after a fashion." And Gandalf replies, "Of course. And why should they not prove true? Surely you don't disbelieve the prophecies because you had a hand in bringing them about yourself."
"You don't really suppose, do you, that all your adventures and escapes were managed by luck? You're a very fine person, Mr. Baggins. And I'm very fond of you. But you're only quite a little fellow. In a wide world, after all."
The story of the Jews is about a little people who today and throughout time have helped bring prophecy about. They also, all too often, doubt it all the more, at times refusing to accept that to be a Jew means to be part of the most miraculous story that could ever be told, a story that is not yet over. Understood this way, there is a remarkable dimension to these new holidays that cannot be found in any other religious Jewish celebration. To mark Israeli Independence Day as a holiday is not only to reflect on the miracle of Jewish endurance, but also another miracle. It is to mark, to celebrate the fact that God's mysterious connection to the Jewish people, to the chosen people, is so profound and all-embracing that it is often those Jews who may not even believe in chosenness that can ultimately become the greatest embodiment of that chosenness itself. And yet there are times where even for those who fear this notion, a flash of insight when the chosenness for which we are making the case in this lecture is suddenly, momentarily clear. It is with this perspective that we can understand why, 19 years after the establishment of the modern Jewish state, the Jewish people's return to Jerusalem during the Six-Day War became a holiday all its own. And why, for all the famous photographs in Israel's history, the most famous is not an image of military conquest, not Ben-Gurion's declaration of Israel's independence or Begin signing the Camp David Accords, not of Israeli generals or scholars or prime ministers, but of three simple soldiers in the photograph by David Rubinger standing, staring up at the newly liberated Temple Mount on the day that Jerusalem was conquered. Decades later, the photographer who took this photo was asked if he believed that the soldiers at the wall was the best photograph he ever took. "The worst," he replied. "From a photographic perspective, it's a bad picture. A good photograph includes no unnecessary elements. But here," he said, "there are all kinds of people in the background, half a head there, a quarter of a nose there. It's an important photograph, but not a good one." Those are his words. So why is this photograph so powerful? The miraculous nature of Israel's origins allows us to answer this question. The picture of the paratroopers is constantly compared to an American image. Joe Rosenthal's capturing of the moment that American Marines hoisted the Stars and Stripes aloft at Iwo Jima. In fact, however, they are opposites. The Iwo Jima image inspires because of an action that it illustrates, young men working in unison to plant a flag. In Rubinger's photo, the emphasis is the reverse. What is stressed is not action, but sudden inaction. After achieving the most famous Jewish military victory in 2,000 years, the soldiers stand still before the locus of Jewish aspiration. They suddenly seem, to paraphrase Milton Himmelfarb's felicitous phrase, not actors, but rather acted upon. The young man in the middle, Yitzhak Yifat, seems awestruck at being a thoroughly ordinary person caught up in things great and inexplicable. This is the magic of the image. As Yossi Klein-Halevi writes, Rubinger's photo endures in part because of the humility it conveys. At their moment of triumph, the conquerors are themselves conquered. The paratroopers, writes Halevi, epitome of Zionism's new Jews, stand in gratitude before the Jewish past, suddenly realizing that they owe their existence to its persistence and longing. Rubinger's photograph catches a precise historical moment, Yossi writes, the return of the last 2,000 years of Jewish history to the Zionist story. Many of the paratroopers identified themselves as Israelis first, Jews only a distant second. Some weren't quite sure whether they identified as Jews at all. And yet, it is at the wall of all places, symbol of the quietism of exile, where secular Israelis become reconciled with their Jewishness. Perhaps the photograph continues to endure, Yossi wrote, because it caught an even more profound moment in the story of Zionism, the return not only of Jewish identity, but of the Jewish God. Judaism posited a daring idea that God's power and goodness would be revealed not only in the majesty of nature, but in the messiness of history, and even more improbably, in Jewish history. The reverence that many Jews felt toward the photograph of the paratroopers was the stunned realization seemingly reflected in Yitzhak Yifat's upturned face that skeptical secularism may not be an adequate way of understanding the Jewish story, that God may be real after all, end quote. And this is why many Jews mark as a holiday not only the anniversary of Israel's independence, but also the day that Jerusalem was captured, the day three Israeli soldiers stood in seeming reverence at the Western Wall. Because that moment, when captured by Ruminger, also captured the quintessence of the Israeli miracle and all that it tells us about the Jewish people. Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, as Norman Podhoretz once put it, reflects the scandal of Jewish particularity. The uniqueness of this one city in the history of the world testifies to the enduring nature of one people on this earth. The Jewish link to Jerusalem goes hand in hand with the mystery of Jewish eternity and chosenness. Established as Israel's capital when now extinct empires bestrode the world, it was toward Jerusalem that the Jews prayed around the world throughout the ages, binding themselves thereby to one another as empire after empire became the Ozymandias of its age. And by continuing to lay claim to this bond, Jews remind the world that, as Chaim Weizmann said to Arthur Balfour, we had Jerusalem when London was a marsh, or as Disraeli more pithily put it to an anti-Semitic parliamentary opponent, quote, while the ancestors of the right honorable gentlemen were brutal savages in an unknown island, mine were priests in the Temple of Solomon. It was with the Jewish return to Jerusalem that the city has represented what was felt so profoundly by Jews all over the world. We celebrate the day not only because Jerusalem is central to our spiritual lives, but also because it was that moment, captured in the most famous photo in Jewish history, when Jews in Israel and around the world felt profoundly, yes, the heroism of the Israeli infantry, but also the hand of God in our history. And yet, what was once felt by so many has faded. In June of 1967, Jews of all stripes flooded toward the Temple Mount. Recently, I attended the celebration of the 50th Yom Yerushalayim in Israel, featuring a parade of religious Zionist youth into the Old City, and was struck by how not a single male Israeli without a skullcap, at least that I could see, took part. The holiday is now for religious Jews, and even for those who are not secular in outlook. Throughout the year, it is possible to live today in a united Jerusalem without the clarity of realization that occurred on the original Jerusalem Day. Yossi Kleinelevi concludes his reflections on Rubinger's Western Wall photograph by noting that, quote, the mythic lure that first brought me to Israel has largely faded. Every day I drive to work from my home in the French Hill in northeastern Jerusalem to the other side of the city, along the route where the paratroopers fought in June 1967. Yet most mornings I am too preoccupied by traffic, by annoying drivers, and by vague security anxieties to notice the view outside my window. But then, he writes, I suddenly remember where I am. I recall my father's wonder at the wall, whose fragile and improbable endurance he saw as a metaphor for the Jewish people. Like him, I ask myself what it is about this strange little people that continually finds itself at the center of international attention, repeatedly on the front lines against totalitarian forces of evil, Nazism, Soviet communism, now jihadism, all of which have marked the Jews as the primary obstacle to achieving world domination. At those moments, he concludes, I feel gratitude for having found my place in this story. The modern holidays of Israel's birth and the Jewish return to Jerusalem are, rightly understood, a call to acknowledge God's hand in history, a call to acknowledge the Jewish people's miraculous place in history, a call to feel gratitude for finding our own place in this story. These holidays are, first and foremost, a call to recognize miracles in our time and to ponder what these miracles mean for our faith and for the lives that we live. The 7-year-old survivor with which we began, Israel Meir Lau, was placed with other children from Buchenwald by Rabbi Schachter on a transport to France. He would always remember the rabbi, but he had no idea who it was who had protected him during the shooting, who had shielded the Jewish child right before he met the Yiddish-speaking chaplain. As he describes in his memoir, Rabbi Lau, with his brother Naftali, made his way to Palestine, went to yeshiva, and he entered the rabbinate. The first major position for which he was interviewed was chief rabbi of Netanya. Interviewing for the job with city officials, he encountered many questions from the mayor of Netanya and his staff. The deputy mayor of Netanya, a man by the name of David Analevich, who ought to have been involved in the interview, sat on the side and oddly said nothing. As the interview came to a close, Analevich stood up and said, friends, honored rabbi, before we disperse, please allow me to say my piece. In a minute you will understand why I have remained silent this whole time. I have been reliving 11 April 1945. I was deported from my hometown to Buchenwald. On April 11th, American airplanes circled in the skies above the camp. The prisoners, myself among them, were first out of the barracks. As we ran, a hail of bullets passed us. Among those running toward the gate was a little boy. I jumped on top of him, threw him to the ground, and lay over him to protect him from the bullets. And today I see him before me alive and well. Now, he said, I declare this to all of you. I, David Anilevich, was saved from that horror, fought in the Palmach, and today serve as deputy mayor of an Israeli city. He then banged on the table so that all the glasses shook and said, if I have the merit of seeing this child, whom I protected with my body, to become my spiritual leader, then I say to you that there is a God. The definition of a miracle is an event that should not naturally have occurred. For us, this tends to mean the splitting of the sea, the stopping of the sun, the opening of the earth. Yet by the very same definition, it is a miracle that Israel was born and endured the way that it did. It is a miracle that after a generation in which many Jewish children grew up without parents, let alone grandparents, we have experienced the fulfillment of the prophecy of Zechariah that grandparents will watch their grandchildren play in the streets of Jerusalem. It is a miracle that as anti-Semitism continues to haunt the nations of Europe, religious Judaism flourishes in Israel, even as a now secular Europe demographically dies. More than any other event in the last 100 years, the state that was born in avoidance of any explicit affirmation of Israel's God now stands as the greatest argument for the existence of that very same God. And that is why the seminal moments of this state story will be marked as holidays. They will evolve in ritual and liturgy. But those who mark them as holidays celebrate the miracle that is Israel, the miracles of the story that is the chosen people. And as we celebrate, we pray as well for many more miracles yet to come. Thank you very much. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. If you enjoyed this lecture, please be sure to sign up for future updates and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Thank you for watching.